Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey gang, I hope you are all taking care of yourselves out there. I know we're all searching for a new normal at this point, and I'm going to be honest, that's true for this show too. On one hand, we're figuring out how to be reporters and producers while isolated in our own homes, but it's more than that. We're also trying to understand our mission during this moment of upheaval, how to make ourselves most useful. Which is to say, we're going to be making this up as we go over the coming weeks. We might show some rough edges, and we might do some random-ass stuff, which, you know, that might be kind of cool. But as we started this season, we were looking at the unfinished business of our country's history and thinking about its grip on our future. Well, what is clear is that this is a historic moment we're in right now. So, over the coming weeks, we'll use the show to think in real time about the lasting changes to our society that this crisis will surely create. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety. Hey, Jenny.
Hey.
Is that you?
It's me.
As we all scrambled to rearrange our lives last week to figure out how we're going to live on lockdown for who knows how long, I called up our reporter, Jenny Casas. Where are you?
I'm somewhere in the middle of Ohio, maybe almost out of Ohio.
Jenny moved to New York from Chicago just a few months ago to work on our show. But when I reached her, she had just decided at the spur of the moment to rent a car and drive nearly 13 hours back to Chicago.
I'm close to Mansfield and Marion, Lima.
Wow. I asked Jenny to turn on her recorder while we talked.
Can you hear me okay?
Are there a lot of people on the road, or is it normal, or few people, or...
I've never done this drive before, but it seems super empty. Like, it's just a lot of Amazon Go trucks and, like, young people driving.
Right.
I'm getting an image of The Walking Dead.
Oh, I've never seen it. Maybe I should watch when I get to Chicago.
I only watched the first couple seasons, so I don't know. But in those seasons, there's a lot of, like, empty highway roads.
Yeah, it does feel... And it's, like, those winter trees, like, you know, just, like, a bunch of forest. It's a little eerie. All of the rest stops in Pennsylvania were closed, and so it just felt like no exit, like, gotta go, get out of this state. It was just, like, deeply unnerving, and maybe, like, everything felt sort of full of meaning for no reason. Do you want to know how fast I'm driving right now?
How fast are you going?
I'm just kidding. I can't tell you. It's too fast to say on air.
Slow down. Slow down. Last night when you decided I'm going to go, was it about leaving something here? Or was it about running to something?
I think...
Is it more push or pull?
It's probably a good mix of both. Yeah, like, it, New York, I will not be the first person to say this, but it is a tough place to create community. And I think... There really is only, like, a handful of people. I don't even know if I would say a handful. I think there's, like, one person I trust in New York that, like, if I called them and was like, I'm sick, I need someone to bring me groceries, like, can you support me in this? Like, there's one person I can call. And in Chicago, that number is, like, at least 10, like, I just know the infrastructure, like the community infrastructure that I've built there over time has, like, it still wants to hold me. And I think that that's the difference is like, I'm just like thinking about where do I want to be in this moment, and this like moment that probably I will remember for the rest of my life, almost certainly.
Well, I mean, I felt like this was the right choice for
you.
But
why do you think it's a good idea?
Well, for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of them being I just think people should be at whatever they consider to be the closest thing to home right now, and whatever that represents to them. And so it feels to me like you're trying to find that, and whatever your process is for finding that is valid and necessary.
Thank you.
Okay, well, safe travels, and congratulations on going home.
I'm excited. I'll let you know how it goes.
The scale of disruption that this outbreak has caused, and the fact that it is likely to go on for some time, that's going to force so many people to ask the kind of fundamental questions Jenny confronted when she got in that car. Questions about our work, about our relationships, even to ask simply, where's my home? This outbreak and all that comes with it, it's also going to force us to make some fundamental choices together as a country. I mean, already, as people have begun to die and as hospitals have begun to be overwhelmed, we're being forced to think about dramatic changes to our health system and how it delivers care. So to me, it's clear there will be no return to normalcy after this. It will change us. My questions are how so and how we'll manage it. And for starters, I'm wondering how we will make it through all of this without falling over the same big, ugly barrier of racism and prejudice.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus?
Which has blocked progress in this country for centuries now.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. It comes from China. I want to be accurate. Yeah, please, John, please.
So I called somebody who has spent decades thinking about how bias operates in a crisis situation and how to interrupt it.
It's been keeping me up at night trying to figure out how can we put in place what you might call a fail-safe system for people of color during this pandemic so that our historic and contemporary inequities and structures of inequity don't exacerbate an already dangerous situation.
That's next.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk. And together, we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
Right as the first cases of coronavirus were starting to show up in the U.S., I met Dr. Gail Christopher at a health conference in Mississippi. Her work is focused on how racism shows up in healthcare, but it's very much about solving the problem, not just diagnosing how racism screws us all up. So I wanted to follow up on what she had to say now that the crisis is just really in full swing. I got her on the phone from her house in Maryland.
Thank you, Kai.
I guess, first off, how are you self-isolating? How's it going?
I'm doing really well. My daughter and her husband and my grandson is a year and a half old, they just decided to leave New York and come and self-isolate with me here in Maryland.
And why? Why?
Because they didn't want to be in New York self-isolating. I think they also didn't want me to be alone.
Uh-huh.
And so it turned out to make this a blessing for all of us. You know, I get to spend quality time with my grandson and be with them. And so, you know, it's amazing how sometimes there's something wonderful in what appears to be something else, you know?
Dr. Christopher has this story she tells often to sort of help people understand how and why our bias, our prejudgments on all sorts of things, how they show up when we're making urgent, consequential decisions. If you look for her online, you'll probably find video of her telling this story. It's kind of like a selection from the greatest hits of public health lectures.
Well, I tell this story when I'm speaking sometimes because I like to remind folks that, you know, bias doesn't make you a racist. Bias makes you human. We are all biased in some form or another. So I watch HGTV because I don't, you know, like these shows where people get killed and maimed. You know, I tried to find a station where, you know, there's not that happening, right? But if you watch enough HGTV, you're going to remodel your house if you can, right? So eventually, you know, I decided, okay, I'm going to have to remodel my kitchen and I'm going to have to take the wall down because, right, you're going to create an open space, you know. So demolition day comes and, you know, they're there snatching down the cabinets, you know, just like on, you know, television.
Yeah.
And then the supervisor came to the people who were on site and he said, well, what are you going to do if that wall is load bearing? And he said, well, don't worry, it's not. He said, but what are you going to do if it is? So he said, we have a plan, you know. So I was nervous, but I ran on upstairs to pack my suitcase because I had to fly out. And while I was upstairs, my house started to really shake, rattle, and roll. I mean, literally, to do the Watusi.
Because the wall's coming down.
You know, and I run downstairs, and all the workmen have run outside. And so I said, what have you done to my house? And the lead contractor on site, he looks me dead in the eye, and he says, no, ma'am, it's an earthquake. Well, I put my hands on my hips and I started to channel my Alabama-born mother. And I said, look, what kind of fool do you think I am? This is Washington, D.C. We don't have earthquakes, you know. He said, no, ma'am, I'm from Guatemala. Go back inside, turn on the TV, you'll see. And so I go back inside and I turn on the TV and there it is across the bottom of the screen. 5.6 earthquake hits the deep. Mm. I mean, really?
Wow.
What are the chances that at the precise moment they're going to take down that wall? Earthquake. But in that moment when I called him everything but a child of God and really, you know, diminished and demeaned this man, my bias that I had grown up with, which my father had deeply, right, was an anti-Latino bias.
Mm.
It came up and it came out. I didn't even know I had it.
I'm worried that if this pandemic doesn't begin to slow down, we will get into a situation where we may not have enough resources.
It's a critical tool that saves lives, the ventilator, better known as a breathing machine. And American hospitals are concerned this morning that there aren't enough around to help patients who get sick with the coronavirus.
And the reality is that what we're seeing right now in our emergency rooms is dire.
We have tremendous amounts of equipment, but compared to what we're talking about here, this has never been done before.
When our stress responses go up, right, when our cortisol and our adrenal hormones are at a higher level of production, when we're afraid or nervous or worried, that's when we will be more inclined to act on our biases. And so you have to think that so many of these healthcare workers, bless their hearts, A, they're afraid, they're tired, they're at risk themselves. And in those conditions, the likelihood that they will unconsciously, and I really do mean unconsciously, act upon and perhaps rationalize these decisions that are really rooted more in bias than in their empathetic, compassionate connection to the perceived other.
I have to say, ever since this outbreak began, I mean, before it even started in the United States, when I was seeing it start to spread around the globe, I had this, what I call my Katrina feeling, you know, where I thought, oh my goodness, you know, when it gets bad, are Black people and other people of color and folks who don't have resources in general going to get triaged out of the response in the way that they did then? And, you know, for things like when they choose who's going to get to get one of these limited respirators, for instance. I mean, is that a reasonable fear for me to have in thinking about how bias operates?
I think it's always a reasonable fear for us to have that the structural and systemic inequities will put us at greater risk and make us more likely to suffer more. I think that that is a very reasonable fear, but more importantly, we're not tracking the disproportionate or proportionate incidence of the condition. We're not tracking right now the hospitalizations and the outcomes. We can't mitigate and prevent those kinds of inequities and disparities if we're not aware of them, if we're not monitoring. It's been keeping me up at night trying to figure out how can we put in place what you might call a fail-safe system for people of color during this pandemic, so that our historic and contemporary inequities and structures of inequity don't exacerbate an already dangerous situation.
Dr. Christopher knows firsthand how this bias happens. She has lived it in very personal ways. So who is Ntianu?
So Ntianu is the name of my firstborn child, my firstborn daughter. And, you know, I was very young at the time and recently married and, you know, gave birth to this beautiful baby girl. And we took her for her 6-week checkup, and the doctor took a long time listening and, you know, examining her. And then he came out and said, I want you to take her over to the pediatric center at the university hospitals because there is something wrong. So we anxiously, you know, took her over there, and after what seemed like forever, you know, they came out and told us that Ntianu had been born with a congenital heart defect. Mm. They told us the name of the defect was tetralogy of Fallot, and basically it's a malformed heart. Mm. And they said to us, there's nothing we can do until she's 5 years old. And at that point, we may be able to do open heart surgery. And I asked, well, what are we to do in the meantime? And they said, we'll just monitor. She'll be okay.
She wasn't okay. About 3 weeks later, Ntianu passed in her sleep.
And of course, I was searching for something to do, right? And in my search, I discovered holistic health and well-being. I went on to study holistic health, to become a licensed naturopath and naturopath, and to really focus on clinical nutrition. But I really immersed myself in the understanding of infant mortality, as they call it, and maternal mortality. And I spent much of my early practice and career helping women to have healthy babies. And so I've come to think of her as a special soul that came into my life, and her coming into my life put me on my career path. And so I have a special place in my heart in terms of remembering the gift she gave me.
About 20 years into that career, Dr. Christopher learned something shocking. Ntianu's death had been entirely avoidable. There was, in fact, a procedure that could have saved her life, and it had been in use for years by the time Dr. Christopher showed up at that hospital with her daughter looking for help. So why do you think it wasn't offered to her?
You know, I'll never know the answer to that. We were a Black couple, young. Who knows what the assumptions were then in terms of whether we could afford it, whether it should be done. I don't really know the answer to that, Kai. I know that it wasn't, you know. I believe it had something to do with racism. It was quite upsetting, and it just reinforced for me my commitment to ending the racial divide in this country, to not the divide, but to ending racism, mm-hmm. to ending the belief that some people have more value and worth than others.
Dr. Christopher says we're blocked by a set of beliefs that are at this point so deeply wired into each of us. This idea that humans of different so-called races are not the same kind of humans. And she argues the only way forward as a society, not just in our health system, but in our schools and courts and workplaces, the only way we'll get to real equality is if masses of people achieve what she's called racial healing. And she's created a well-known truth and reconciliation process to facilitate that healing. That's the urgent threat to our well-being that she wants us to confront. And part of what I called her up to talk about now is, honestly, I'm having trouble buying into that healing as a priority. My own perspective on bias has often been, I really just don't care whether or not white people have bias. I don't care how they feel about me or anybody else. What I care about is their inability to act on those biases. Particularly in a moment like this, I'm like, I don't have time to worry about what's in your heart. This is life and death.
And that's a very compelling argument. And I've heard people say it repeatedly. They will say things like, I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you think. Just treat me well, right? Be fair. My response to that is, I may have laws in place to prevent discrimination, and I may have rules in place to say that your behavior has to be a certain way. We find a way to circle back to the embedded biases and the embedded hierarchy of human value. Let's demand from the Supreme Court that the schools be integrated, right? Let's say that we can't discriminate in housing. Let's say that doctors have to be held to a higher standard. Let's say no to discrimination. If you look back on it, we've been doing that for the last 50 years.
Yeah, fair enough.
And things have not, we're not whole. And what I try to do is say, don't fall into the trap, the Western ideological trap of dichotomous thinking, right? It is not either or, folks. It is both and. We never really did the work of eradicating the permission to devalue our humanity. And that's why Reconstruction failed. That's why we had the era of the 1920s where we had this resurgent in Confederate flags and monuments and all of those things that speak of this false notion that there's superiority based on physical characteristics.
This is something we've been wrestling with all season, right? I mean, the missed opportunity of those Reconstruction years, right after the Civil War. Things had been going so well in the effort to create a true interracial democracy and economy. Why did it all fall apart? Dr. Christopher turned to the history of medicine to illustrate her answer to this.
Since antiquity, when there was inflammation, when there was war going on in the body, you suppressed that inflammation. And we have all different categories of drugs, from herbs to medicines, that are designed to quiet the inflammation, right? And in a sense, you could say that's what we've done with this notion of slavery and Reconstruction. We have interventions designed to fix it, to quiet it, to make it go away. Mm. In the 21st century, we've now discovered that there's this new category of molecules that are necessary to resolve the inflammation, right? To help the body clear away the debris so that you don't end up with the scarring and the autoimmune diseases and the chronic problems that came about as a result of the inflammation. And so I like to think of the work of racial healing as a pro-resolving mediation or intervention so that we can clear away the debris that's left over from our periods of ignorance and cruelty and organized lovelessness as a society. We've got to do the work, I think.
I'm going to sit with that. It's a big shift for me, the idea that I'd invest in fixing somebody else's bias. But I hear Dr. Christopher. I can't argue the point. And like I said at the start, this is a time when a lot of us are going to have to face fundamental change, including in our own thinking. For now, Dr. Christopher also gave me a bunch of advice on how to weather this storm and stay healthy doing it in mind and in body. We're all spending this time together alone. We're social distanced. You've got your family there, but what are you doing to stay connected?
You know, we are spending as much time in nature as we can together. Walking through the woods on the trails, keeping the necessary social distance when our neighbors, you know, are involved. But within our family, we are very much spending as much time in nature as we can, recognizing that trees actually give off chemicals that help to reduce cortisol.
Really?
And reduce the stress response. Mm-hmm. Especially after it rains, and especially evergreen trees, which we have a lot of. And so it is healing, and we're going to take advantage of that.
I have 13 little juniper trees planted in my courtyard behind my house, and this is why I feel so good when I sit by them.
Yes, indeed. It's real.
How about that?
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you for that. It was lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for this time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for what you do.
Well, like I said earlier, we're going to riff a bit on what we do on this show over the coming weeks, and maybe over the coming months. We'll see. And we want to hear from you as we do that. I really hope we can host more live call-ins like the one we did a couple of weeks back. Check that out if you haven't heard it. But in the meantime, just hit us up and tell us what's on your mind. What big lasting changes are you seeing, are anticipating, are just wondering about? Record a voice memo and send it to me at anxiety@wnyc.org. We just want to be useful. So tell us what we can do to help. Talk to you more soon and stay healthy. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was produced by myself and Vera Lynn Williams. It was edited by Christopher Wirth, and this week's episode was mixed by Curtis McDonald. Our executive producer is Karen Frillman. Casey Means is our technical director. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, Marianne McCune, and Jessica Miller. With help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki, our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. And keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thanks for listening.
The United States of Anxiety's health coverage is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health that ensures everyone in America has a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org.